This month's community worship theme is trust. And today I'm going to be speaking about truth and what it means to seek truth, all kinds of truth, in our Unitarian Universalist congregation, particularly in view of our fourth principle. And I invite you to open your hymn book to the last page before the first hymn. That page conveniently has no numbers or other indicators on it, so that's the way to find it. And this is a copy of our foundational Unitarian Universalist Covenant. And at the top are our seven principles, and at the bottom are our six sources. So let us read the opening to the covenant that ends with affirm and promote, and then let's read the fourth principle together, which starts with A free. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Thank you. Both trust and truth come into modern English from slightly different language paths, but they both go back to the same word in the pre-Germanic language. That word is treuvas, which means having or characterized by good faith. And interestingly, that understanding of faith was used in both the secular and the religious sense. And treuvas goes back to Proto-Indo-European, which is the mother language of many languages in Europe, the Middle East, and East Asia. And the root word there is deru, meaning to be firm, solid, and steadfast. So with both trust and truth, we have root deep meanings of good faith and of being firm and steady and solid. So I am not going to speak today about truth in a philosophical sense, because that's pretty floaty stuff. I am more interested in how we go about the search for truth in this religious community, our very own one, religious and spiritual truth, how we recognize and know those truths as truths, and also what is our duty regarding truth as Unitarian Universalist? And that's a really pragmatic or practical approach to truth, meaning how do we live in relationship to our understanding of and search for truth, and how does that bring us to trust in our congregation? One of the more interesting and informative and perhaps cautionary stories of the search for religious truth comes from the city of Münster in what is now northwest Germany, and it's where the red marker is, during the early Reformation. The Protestant Reformation is said to have begun in 1517 when Martin Luther nailed his 95 Theses of Belief to a Roman Catholic church door in Wittenberg, Germany. That was like the official start of the Reformation, but a lot of folks and a lot of groups had been challenging many aspects of Roman Catholic faith and practice for centuries before that, and they often had been suppressed harshly. What made the difference was the printing press. That's what made the Reformation happen. So other leaders than Luther and other reproaches to the reform of the Roman Catholic faith quickly rose after 1517, and it was more than a century before things settled down to some degree, and only to some degree, and new and various denominations of Protestant Christianity became well established and well defined, including among them European Unitarianism. But in that century and a bit more, it's a bit more than a century, in that time, in that process, there was tons of hideous violence, compounded by a few bouts of bubonic plague that swept across Europe. And this violence was on the part of individuals, rulers, national governments, religious institutions, violence against individuals and groups, and major wars, all about religious truth. So in a good way, this was a time of religious exploration and questioning on a scale it's hard to imagine today. And at the same time, folks wanted to enforce their new truths that they were learning and receiving way too often with violence. So after 1517, various types of Protestantism emerged quickly, and some of them would be names we would recognize today. And a third way of religious belief soon emerged in Central Europe, apart from the groups that we now know as Protestants and apart from the Roman Catholic tradition. And this was the Anabaptist movement, the ancestors of the people we know today as the Mennonites and the Amish. And they differed significantly, which is why they were a third way, from both the emerging Protestant folks and from Roman Catholics. They differed on a number of issues relating to church practice and to the sacraments, especially baptism. Anabaptist means re-baptized. Because one of the things that these folks believe most powerfully is that the choice of committing to a religious faith can only be, should be, an adult choice. That choosing a religious tradition or committing yourself to it via baptism is not something infants can even do. They are not capable of that. So they began to practice adult rather than infant baptism. And so the early founders of the Anabaptist movement all went what was for them, they went through a second baptism in acknowledgement of that. Hence, they were Anabaptist. So in January of 1534, a group of Anabaptists took over the city of Münster by force to establish a communal government based on their vision and version of Anabaptism and also their vision and version of a better society. And before taking over the city, they had sent out notices all over northern Germany and the Netherlands. You can see Münster is pretty close to the Netherlands, inviting folks to come to Münster to help them build the new Jerusalem. And it was partly this influx of people that gave them the people power to take over the city. They were joined in this by some of the ministers and some of the members of some of these brand new Lutheran churches. This was Germany. Most of these folks involved in the rebellion were peasants and tradespeople, working people. Many of them were poor, but there were some prominent merchants and other wealthy people who also were leaders. The rebels expelled the Roman Catholic bishops and priests and also all the city magistrates and leaders. They also went into a giant spasm of iconoclasm, literally iconoclasm, meaning they went into Roman Catholic churches and Lutheran churches and destroyed all the icons and religious representations of saints and other people. And they also killed many of the people in the city who opposed them. One of their leaders, Jan Beckelsen, declared himself the king of Münster. He claimed he had received visions from God in heaven directing him what to do. And included in the order of things in the new theocracy of Münster was polygamy. Men could now have multiple wives. Isn't it interesting how the idea of polygamy so often seems to be the received religious truth when we look at this time in history? All goods were also declared to be held in common, which in practice meant that King Jan and his followers took pretty much what they wanted and distributed the rest as they saw fit. Anyone who resisted significantly was killed, including some of the women who were ordered to be wives. They decided they would rather die than do that. So all men were to be equal, but clearly some were still more equal than others. Over the time of the occupation, the Anabaptist leaders became intolerant of their radical Lutheran allies and claimed total control. And at that point, rebaptism became compulsory for all citizens. In April 1534, just a few months after the takeover, the Roman Catholic bishop who had been forced out of the city brought a military force to retake it. He did not succeed, but he did put the city under siege. And after that, food became increasingly scarce. And after months of the siege, people were starving. This is an image of the siege of Munster. You see it, the town or the little red buildings there in the middle. It was a classic walled small city. So the Anabaptist king and his people held and ruled Munster for about a year and a half, until June of 1535, and that's when the city was retaken by the Roman Catholic forces who had besieged it. Men, women, and children who were identified as Anabaptists were killed. The rebel rulers of the city were executed by torture in the public square, and their bodies were placed in iron cages in the steeple of the main Roman Catholic church, St. Lambert's, for all to see. So here's an image of the execution of the leaders. And if you look, there's St. Lambert's. And if you see the clock face, look up there. And right at the top of the image are the three cages awaiting them. Here's an interesting thing. This is the cathedral today, the church. Those cages are still there. A cautionary tale, but I'm not sure what the point is that they're making. Well, I can imagine if someone proposed to take them down. Oh, my goodness. What a furor I'm sure that would set off. And they appear to keep them quite shiny. So, the Munster Rebellion is a cautionary tale of the search for religious truth and how it can go so wrong. And this event had far-reaching effects on the development of the Anabaptist faiths as well as people's responses to that faith, because there was now 100 years that came on after this of religious-based strife, violence, and war among and between Roman Catholics, Protestants, and Anabaptists, culminating in the 30 Years' War, which pretty much encompassed all of mainland Europe, before finally, after literally millions of people had died, you know, with the Black Death and everything, before religious and secular leaders in Central Europe decided that a type of peace must be reached, and that varied approaches to religious truth could be endured if not affirmed. The Treaty of Westphalia was signed in 1648 that ended this whole century-plus-long furor of religious violence. The treaty was signed in Munster. So, how do we know religious and spiritual truths when we find them? And I don't think this is so much about the nature of truth, but about our methods for knowing our truths as true, for trusting them. So how do we know what is true? And it is really, in some ways, a question of what we consider to be authoritative as much as it is of facts or not facts. So what is it that we, as Unitarian Universalists, hold to be reliable sources or ways of discerning spiritual or religious truth? John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, came up with really quite a nifty method for describing sources of religious truth. As all you former Methodists, I know you know, it is known as the Methodist or Wesleyan quadrilateral, because there are four of these sources. So, although today some Methodists believe their quadrilateral is a hierarchy, with these sources of truth being in a certain order from most to least important, I've had Methodists tell me that, John Wesley said they were equal in importance. So as you can see, the sources of truth are scripture, tradition, reason, and experience. And I think these do encompass pretty much all the ways that a person can determine religious truth. But of course, people in different faiths might define them a little bit differently. For Unitarian Universalist, I would define scripture more broadly as all the accumulated wisdom of the centuries from whatever source we have received it. Could be sacred text from many faiths, could be secular text, it could be the stories and the teachings and the lives of prophetic or even not so prophetic people that all increase our religious knowledge, that develop our own understanding of religious or spiritual truth that are inspirational for us. Because we do have our own much more specific description of what we consider to be reliable sources of truth and meaning. What do we have? What are they?
The six sources.
The six sources. And they address these four types of truth, just in more specific and poetic kinds of ways. So Unitarian Universalists, because of our own history and theology, we do tend to downplay tradition as a big source for religious truth. We are encouraged more to question various traditions and to test their value and meaning for ourselves in forms of practice that we develop for ourselves. Now, forever, Unitarian Universalists have always given reason a high place in our determining of truth. Also, due to our history and heritage, back in the 18th and 19th centuries, one of the reasons that we valued reason was to oppose what was seen at the time as overly emotional or hysterical aspects of religious belief and practice that swept through our country on several occasions. These were called the Great Awakenings, and there were several of them. And people would be rolling around on the ground and frothing at the mouth at public preaching gatherings. And the emerging Unitarians were like, whoa, wait a minute. We think we see that differently. Reason also was used to question aspects of religious truth that didn't fit with the growing scientific understanding of the world. For example, in the early 19th century, a lot of Unitarians moved fairly quickly to a disbelief in the miracle stories of the Bible as being literally true. That was a big honking deal in the early 19th century, even among Unitarians at first, to say, you know, those miracles, they just couldn't have been true. One of my heroes, the Reverend Theodore Parker, a Unitarian, almost got defrocked over that very early on in our movement. Finally, there is experience. And this is not only our experience of the world, but the way we understand and interpret our experiences and decide what truth they bring us. So this includes the evidence of our senses and our intuition and our emotional responses to our lives and our environment, our gut feelings about truth. In his first letter to the Thessalonians in the Christian New Testament, Paul writes powerfully of the place of experience and reason in finding truth. He wrote, "Do not despise the words of prophets, but test everything. Hold fast to what is good." Paul sounds very Unitarian Universalist when he says this. Look to the collective wisdom of the ages, but run it all by your brain and your heart. Test everything. And when you've found your good truth, hold on to it. So as we search for our own and our shared religious and spiritual truths, using our experience, our reason, collective wisdom, and our own Unitarian Universalist traditions, what is our duty to the truth? What do we owe it? That fourth principle that we read gives us the guidance. Our search must be free and responsible. Free means that we should be unfettered in our search. We should be free to seek where we want to share and discuss everything along the way in our searching and our finding of truth. And generally, we Unitarian Universalists don't have a struggle with the free part of free and responsible. We get that. I think for us it's the responsible part that can be more of a challenge. A responsible search for truth is certainly one that is disciplined, meaning we keep our focus, we keep our attention. Without that focus, we might turn away from truths that are challenging. So we owe it to ourselves, to our potential for transformation, to be steady in our search for truth, and to respond to truths that might feel disturbing by continuing to explore them for deeper understanding. In our meditation words this morning, the poet Gwendolyn Brooks uses the sun as a metaphor for truth. And she says, "We have wept and prayed for the sun, the light of truth. But what will we really do when that truth comes knocking on our door? Might we not be frightened by the light of truth after being in the shade? Will we turn from it and run? It can be sweet," she says, "to sleep in the coolness of our unawareness." So a responsible search for truth and meaning urges us to resist that comfortable sweetness. So another aspect of responsible search for religious truth is it needs to be done in community. So we are called by our third principle to encourage one another to spiritual growth. So we are called to share our truths with one another, to put them out there for others to hear and respond to. So that response might be agreement, it might be challenge, it might be refinement or expansion. And through that process, our own understanding of truth grows more powerfully. Through that process, which is really a process of shared intimacy and vulnerability, putting your truths out there, we will come to understand and therefore respect and love one another more deeply, regardless of our agreement about religious truth. In ancient Rome, the goddess of truth was named Veritas. She was often holding a mirror as the symbol of truth. When we share our religious truth with others and we ask to hear theirs, we are holding up mirrors in which we can each see our own truths, like reflected back and forth in other eyes. And thus, we have the chance to learn more and grow more. Accountability is also part of that responsibility aspect of the search for truth. That's another reason why community is so important. We are accountable to one another for the ways we seek truth, how we share it, and how we respond to the truths that are held by others. So we have to do this in ways that are in keeping with our seven principles and our covenant of right relation, in ways that are founded foundationally in our love for one another. What the Anabaptist rulers of Munster did not have, among many things, was that accountability. Once the rulers are in place, they pretty much did as they pleased, which was pretty much their model for rulership. This was all like pre-democracy. And while some of their religious and social ideas were actually good, too many of their practices were unacceptable and violent, and then met with violence. So sharing our evolving or deeply held truths invites and encourages us to face truths that can be hard to face alone as we share, as we are accountable. Truths we might have to approach over and over again before we can accept them, even when there's a lot of evidence of our own experience and reason. So our community helps us do that. Finally, what else might be included in our duty to truth? Our Unitarian Universalist tradition teaches us it is critical to remember that we don't have to agree on the important religious truths of our lives. What we need to do is remember to love one another even when we don't agree in religious or other ways. We need to hear the truths about ourselves and our beliefs as observed by others, always spoken with love. These beliefs about truth and love have come to us from our own Unitarian Universalist traditions. One of the best expressions of that truth, we have been told, is from Francis David, the great Unitarian reformer of Transylvania. David is reported to have said, "We need not think alike to love alike." However, as a 2012 article written by Peter Hughes in our UU World magazine points out, there never has been a solid source for that quotation or a written one. And it looked quite a bit like a statement from another European religious reformer. Hughes writes, "The saying is almost identical to a well-attested quotation from the Methodist founder, John Wesley, who asked in a sermon, 'Though we cannot think alike, may we not love alike?'" Hughes goes on to discuss how he found this came to Unitarian Universalism. He says, "The attribution to David surfaced for the first time in the early 1960s. Richard Beek heard it while on a tour in Transylvania in 1964. He published it in a pamphlet titled A Universe of Common Freedom in 1968, and from there it made its way to John Buren's and Forrest Church's book A Chosen Faith in 1991 and on to many other Unitarian Universalist publications." So Hughes asks us to wonder if it really matters that David most likely did not give us this cherished saying. Will it mean as much to us if it is from John Wesley instead of a Unitarian Universalist forebear? Will we go on attributing it to a more comfortable source and story, regardless of truth and accuracy? Hughes thinks our commitment to a free and responsible search for truth and meaning requires us to welcome and embrace a more complicated story of this beloved saying. A story, as he points out, that doesn't take anything away from its essential truth. It is in our willingness to embrace the more uncomfortable aspects of religious truth that our greatest growth, our greatest transformation can occur. So, spiritual homework. In the coming weeks, I invite you to ponder the powerful sources of religious truth for you. How have experience, reason, the wisdom of others, and tradition shaped your truths through our six sources? How have they shaped you? What have been religious and spiritual truths that were a struggle for you to accept, even when they're held by others and not you? Which truths have felt like a sweet homecoming? If you can, please share your stories of truth with others in our beloved community. So I invite and invoke blessings on your searches for and your sharings of religious truth. May they be free, responsible, and transformative. Blessed be, and amen.